ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Campbell Costello is a man whose work has taken him out of a cattle property in North Queensland all the way out to Kazakhstan and Mongolia and Nepal and Pakistan and South America. Campbell is not an explorer, nor is he an aid worker, a doctor without a border, or a diplomat. Campbell is a vet, and it's the animals that lure him to these places. He's acted as the official vet for a sled race in Alaska and for the Mongolian Derby, an epic horse race that's described as 600 miles of beautiful hell across the vast Eurasian steppe. It's a hammering wild ride that Campbell participated in himself a while back. Since then, Campbell has returned to Australia. He's got himself a pilot's license, trained a dog to act as his co-pilot, and now he treats ill and injured animals all over the top end. Hello, Campbell.
G'day, boss. How are you?
All right, sir. Not bad at all. You've recently swapped your horse and your Land Rover for a plane. What made you decide to go out and get your pilot's license?
A variety of factors. I think sort of growing up in the bush on a cattle station, my father was a pilot. Both my grandfathers were pilots, so there was a reasonable legacy in aviation in the bush. It sort of made sense after a while that rather than me driving, spending 3 or 4 days in a motor vehicle to get where I needed to, or spending incredible amounts of time on commercial flights and in airports to start flying myself.
So does this mean you service the whole of the top end, all that epic land across northern Australia?
Yeah, I'd like to think that I'd have one of the larger consult rooms in the world. I've been lucky to service areas up the peninsula of Queensland, across Arnhem Land and the top end of the Northern Territory, down through the Central Deserts area, and I have worked in the Kimberley area of WA as well.
How about Channel Country in Western Queensland? Do you fly over that a lot and see that a lot?
Yeah, I was very lucky to fly over the Channel Country and see the Diamantina in full flood, just near Batuta.
God, that's so beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I had some passengers with us and, it was sort of late afternoon, beautiful cool air, nice cool blue sky day, and we dropped altitude a little bit just to sort of see that sun glistening, off a pseudo Everglade, you'd almost call it. Black swans and pelicans everywhere. It's absolutely phenomenal, the desert and the Channel Country right now. And at altitude, the reds and the yellows and the blues, they just really stand out in that late afternoon and early morning. Yeah, it just gives you a different perspective. Sometimes when you're driving across these deserts or the Barkly Tablelands or northern Queensland, it's hours and hours and hours till you see any sign of civilization, and it can make you feel sort of very small and insignificant in the bush. But when you get up in the air, you can almost sort of see the curvature of the earth and just the vastness of nothing. It's beautiful, it's lonely, but it's really humbling. And I always feel like I'm at home when I'm there.
Lonely apart from your co-pilot. Tell me about this co-pilot of yours.
So I've got a little co-pilot that has started poking around on my veterinary rounds. His name is Henry. Henry, I'm not really sure how old he is. I estimate 14 months, maybe. He's a lovely little dog that gets chained up in the back seat on his little blanket. Yeah, he's a dog, the colloquial term we'd use as a camp dog. So he's from an Indigenous community, the Fink community, halfway between Alice Springs and Oonadatta. So I was out there doing a veterinary contract, spaying animals and doing the parasite treatments and disease surveillance. And this dog sort of ran up and said hello and bit me very lightly on the hand and led me down the road to his little collection of soiled blankets. And I was like, oh, this is where I live. And, we sort of had a moment and...
Well, he claimed you, did he? Rather than the other way around.
He found me. Yeah, I was a man, I was an island. I had no... I wasn't letting anyone in. I would sort of walled off myself to be like, no, you don't let anything in. You just keep on your own and keep striving forward. But yeah, this dog found me.
Dog came out and said, get your coat, you're hooked. That was it.
100%. He sort of said hello. Some of the local human nurses were like, oh, my God. He's like, he doesn't really connect with people at all. And he's just sort of run up and said hello. And they eventually said, look, with the tick sickness getting around here, our contracts are all finishing. No one really zones him. We'll ask around town. And I found out that, no one made claims. So here I was departing the Northern Territory with a dog in the back of the plane back to Queensland.
And how does he like being in the air?
he absolutely loves it. So, like, he hears the prop kick over and he gets so excited. You know, if he hears the car or he hears the plane. I was recently doing a veterinary locum for a clinic down in Dubbo in northern New South Wales a couple of months ago, and we had a plane parked there and the Royal Flying Doctor base is there, and you'd be driving towards the parking area for general aviation and all the Royal Flying Doctor planes would be kicking over their props, and he would just start barking and getting so excited, just going, I know what's happening. We're going for a fly. I just can't wait. He loves it.
Can he stick his head out the window? Is that just not possible in a plane like yours?
No, not. It's an enclosed habit, cabin, that one. Maybe one day if I can buy myself a tiger moth, he'll get his little goggles and scarf, and we can go around exploring.
So which part of North Queensland did you grow up in, Campbell?
So home for me, I grew up in a cattle station just outside of Charters Towers. Beautiful area that I now call home again since I've just bought a little property near Townsville. Yeah, we had a cattle station just south of Charters Towers. I was born in Townsville, but christened on the cattle property, did school the area on the station. I was the oldest of four children. And yeah, sort of, I never really thought much differently of it. Just a typical sort of bush kid upbringing. On a station before going away for boarding school.
Isn't there an old Air Force base out there from World War II?
Yeah, there is. During the war, my grandfather gave some land to the Crown. There was two squadrons of Kitty Hawks there fighting the Japanese during the Battle of the Coral Sea. So that is still an active air base. So I remember as a kid, we'd ride our ponies up there and, you know, a cyclone would be rolling into Townsville or Cairns and they'd go and park all the Black Hawks and Chinooks up there. We used to go and watch the old caribous and the Hercules do touch and goes. So, you know, sort of further feeding into that love of aviation as well. But yeah, they still do a lot of training up there today.
So when you were growing up on this property outside of Charters Towers, when you look back as a kid, what kind of sense memories do you have living on that property in that part of the world?
Oh, it's like you'd wake up early in the morning, if it was winter time, you know, there might be a frost, real crisp, cold morning in an old Queensland homestead. You know, not all the floorboards would be totally aligned. You know, so you'd get always this cool draft and you'd rug up in a million layers and run into the kitchen and, you know, mum would have been boiling some corn meat or cooking some breakfast for the stockman and my father, before a big day's work, if we had cattle in the yards, you know, that smell of livestock and dust very subtly hanging in the air and the smell of a wood fire burning from the donkey hot water system out in the backyard. And then, yeah, we'd sort of either go out in the stock camp, bush camp and help out there, or we'd do our school the air lessons. So mum was, you know, I don't know how she did it, to be fair, you know, raising four kids in the classroom at one stage. Plus being a wife, you know, cook, an active part of the stock camp and helping Dad as much as they could.
You describe it really vividly. I wonder if cities seem really antiseptic to you after growing up in such a vivid place like that.
To a certain extent, you know, like I've been very fortunate. I lived in Melbourne once. I've graced the streets of Hong Kong and Moscow many times and Buenos Aires. So, look, don't get me wrong. I love going to the city and expanding my horizons and my mind and food and culture and language. But I guess as I've got older, I've definitely found that I gravitate more towards that frontier and isolation. I feel more home at then. And I do think it's a big part of my identity and who I'm, growing up in the bush.
As the eldest of your siblings, did that mean you had more responsibility? Were you in charge when your parents were away?
You're exactly right. Yeah, I think that you do grow up a lot quicker, A, being on a station, and B, you know, being the eldest. I remember we were in really bad drought in the early 90s and Dad was away with cattle on a gistmill in central Queensland, you know, day or two drive, and we had no mobile phones back in those days, so he'd sort of disappear and we wouldn't hear him for long periods of time. Mum was left behind to run 120,000 acres, running waters and fences as best as she could. So, yeah, you know, there was an aspect of being the eldest, you know, keeping the household safe, looking out for the mum and making sure that my siblings, you know, did their school the air lessons and did their school. My youngest sister, you know, she was 7 years younger, you know, making sure that a nappy was changed and she was fed properly. Yeah, it was a big time to step up as a young person and to understand, you know, responsibility. And as well as that, being a male, you know, sort of being alongside my mother, sort of taking on a pseudo matriarchal role at times, helping, you know, bottle feed the children and feed them and doing domestic tasks. So, yeah, it was a really special place in developing my personal growth at an early age.
Is station life what made you want to become a vet?
It predisposed that choice big time. Being around animals all the time, rather than having friends at school, like you had your siblings, but yeah, you had puppies and chickens and ponies and orphan little calves.
Some of those had to end up on your plate at some point though, didn't they? Some of your mates?
Yeah, definitely. You know, so I think you sort of, I don't know, you were submerged into the circle of life pretty young, so you sort of understood it, you know, like food and the food chain, being accountable, you know, like often we had to slaughter our own animals rather than just getting it from a shop. It's an interesting experience when you are part of that vertically integrated sort of paddock to plate thing. There's a different level of accountability there on a station.
So once you graduated as a vet, it would have been perfectly natural for you to remain in country Queensland as a country vet or maybe worked as in a city vet or something like that. Instead, you went out into the world to some of the more unusual and interesting places of the world.
Yeah, a big catalyst for that. I was very fortunate to sign up and be accepted to ride the world's longest horse race, the Mongol Derby. The Mongol Derby.
Derby Derby.
Yeah, I know. I can hear my British counterparts abroad going, you know, it's pronounced Derby, sir. Like, I graduated from Townsville. Born, raised, educated here. I went into state for a while. But yeah, that was sort of the first thing that really pushed me to go. You know, I remember being mid-20s. There was 34 riders that started at the start of the race and I was one of 16 that finished. So the attrition was over 50%. So, you know, to do such an adventure, experience such an amazing thing, to finish it at a young age, you know, for confidence and personal growth, yeah, it really planted the seed and I had a thirst for more adventure and exploring and sort of to grow my perspective and my thoughts and my brain.
Yeah, like I said, it's described as 600 miles of beautiful hell. What's the course you go on in this Mongol Derby/Derby when you get on the back of your pony out there?
Well, it is structured to a certain extent. You are given a checkpoint you'd have to ride to. It's a recreation of Genghis Khan's old messaging route. So,
what, the old postal system of the Mongols, the Mongol Empire?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, obviously asking a horse to quickly carry a message over 1,000 kilometres is impossible. You know, they'd break down from exhaustion. So what they used to do was place these stations, you know, 30 kilometres apart and gallop the horse point to point. So every 30 kilometres, fresh horse, and you could cover a lot of country in a day to send messages and letters and postal stuff.
Yeah, Mongol warriors, horse warriors, would take 3 horses for each warrior so they could alternate several times during the course of a day so they wouldn't exhaust their ponies. And is that what you do when you ride in the Mongol Derby?
100%, yeah. So, well, not 3 horses at once, but at each checkpoint there is you've got to vet your horse in and obviously it has to be sound, so no signs of lameness, no saddle rubs, no wounds, the heart rate needs to be below a certain rate. That is very, very strict. It's something that after being not only a rider but a veterinarian for it with several years is, you know, the welfare parameters are pretty strict. So once you've passed that, you get a new horse and you keep on riding. So yes, there is some kind of, you know, bricks and mortar as far as the route goes, but it is a bit ad hoc when you're like, well, do I go left of the mountain or right of the mountain? And those choices can either win you a race or bring you, you know, great demise and challenge. And, you know, whether there's just so many things and so many variables that can really make or break it.
Now, I've never been out to that part of the world, but I've seen a lot of footage of it. And what it reminds me of, the footage I've seen, is central Queensland in terms of its extreme flatness, the way the land seems to go on forever on the Eurasian steppe. And when you're inland like that, you see these scudding clouds that just go on and on and on forever until they sort of meet the flat horizon. Is that what you saw out there? Did in some ways remind you of home?
Yeah, it's funny you describe that. I sometimes see some great similarities there. You know, you've got the undulating steppe, as you call it. There's no timber. Little hills and mountains, not massive topography. Until we get into the northern parts, it gets some pretty big mountains there and forests. But yeah, it can remind you of central Queensland and that channel country. from what I've seen as a rider and as a vet, you know, the Australians do really well. You know, we're sort of synonymous and understand and respect that isolation. You know, we'll get a lot of seasoned horsemen and women that go out to Mongolia, but they get on the horse and kick it on and they soon realise, you know, there's no fences, there's not a sand arena, you know, there's not a little day spa at the end of a good ride, you know, that one must go and get a massage. Like it is, you know, you will not bathe for several days. You will eat Mongolian food. You go to the bathroom in a trench toilet and yet you're left to your devices. And I found that the Australians, especially the bushies, they tend to do really well on this race. You know, it doesn't mess with their head like someone from, you know, Europe or the United States that may not have seen this kind of expansive sort of terrain before.
Well, the classic Mongol horsemen also drank fermented mare's milk to keep them going and horse blood when their provisions ran low. I'm sure you must have had a good crack at those things too, Campbell.
I haven't done the blood pancake,
right.
But you're right. They used to, nick the jugular vein and get blood out of their horse to remain strong.
Yeah, only if they absolutely had to. That was the thing, yeah.
Correct, yeah.
But they drank fermented mare's milk all the time, which had a slight alcoholic buzz to it. Did you ever crack at that as well?
I have had many a crack at so they pronounce it their erag.
Yeah.
When I was in Kazakhstan, another place, they call it kumis, but in Mongolia, it's erag.
What's it like? Is it like sort of alcoholic yogurt or something? That's what I'm imagining. Have I got that wrong?
No, 100%. It is alcoholic. And it's funny, different provinces, you know, it's almost like wine, you know, the Mongolians go, oh, you can taste that it's different here and the pastures and the sweetness. There's one place, one family that I went to a couple of times and they're sort of infamous in the bush of Mongolia with their alcoholic mare's milk. They've got an old cow's rumen and they've tanned it and they sort of suspend it up like a massive sort of bladder hammock looking thing. and it gets this weird taste of the erag that only they can produce. But it's sort of like someone left milk out at room temperature.
Yeah.
And had it. It's very tarty, like it's vinegarish, but yeah, it's a great diuretic. It will get you drunk.
Do you get a taste for it, or is it just too alien to the taste of a country boy from Queensland?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's Moorish. Like, I wouldn't go, oh, you know, I haven't been in Mongolia for a couple of years. I really can't wait. I'll drink it when I have the chance. I always tell the newbies, don't get overzealous with your cultural immersion, because I was like, your bathrooms are only slats over a pit, if you're lucky. They call it their summer purge, their clean-out stuff as well. So I always warn people that have never developed a gastrointestinal a tolerance for it to be very careful. But, look, you know, I might go ahead as the vet and be like, hey, you know, we need to get these horses on the line, yada, yada. And they're like, oh, you know, you're a big guy, rugby player looking fella, you know, we must drink horse milk to see if you're, you know, manly enough to do it. And you sort of slam down a couple of bowls of this stuff and sort of grit your teeth together to filter out a bit of the hair and the curd. And it's, you're sort of you're like, holy shit, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. I've got a bit of a buzz on. And I'm about to practice veterinary science. And they're like giving you thumbs up going, oh, this fella's great. Yep, no worries. You are worthy of our ponies now. Yeah, it's a funny one.
And you were, sir. And you were indeed. That's impressive. I'm impressed. I am. I think that's tremendous. So once you've had your couple of bowls of harag and you've climbed on top of the pony and you're charging across this extraordinary horizon, what are you thinking? How does it feel? Is it great or is it get a bit old pretty quickly?
Oh, it's just such a myriad of emotion, you know, like you can be euphoric and feel and just like, wow, look at this, you know, skyline and the countryside and just taking it all in. And then 5 minutes later, you're bawling your eyes out because you're so exhausted and you're chafed and your knees are absolutely killing you.
Are you serious? It does bring you to tears, your frustration?
Oh, it is such a undulating feeling of emotion, you know, and that's why I enjoy it. You know, you strip everyone down. Like we've had Crown Princes of Qatar ride right down to, you know, your salt of the earth, working class people, and it just... No one cares. It strips it all away and everyone's equal. You know, gravity still grabs us all at 9.8 newtons and slams us into the ground. It doesn't care about your breed or where you're from. And I've seen, you know, special forces, big burly men reduced to tears, you know, just going, I'm tired. I've had gastro. I'm so sore and I miss my family. And, you know, they're jubilant and like, oh my God, I'm so happy to see you. This is the best cigarette I've ever smoked in my life. and then just be reduced to tears. It's amazing to see, you know, and that's the game that you have to play. It's not for one day, 2 days. You know, you've given 10 days to have to battle the psychological warfare to keep on going. And, you know, I see it as a vet all the time, but as a rider, it's just something that, you know, you're like, oh, I want to give up. I don't want to ever look at another horse again. I think the best thing about it is it's very grounding. You know, in Western culture, you're like, oh, I've got that meeting. Oh, I've got that bill in a week. Oh, I've got, you know, my BAS or my tax in a couple of months. In that moment, you're like, I just want to finish the next 35 kilometres and not get hurt.
Right. Yeah. Business activity statement, furthest thing from your mind at that moment. So once you came towards the end of this 10-day experience, how were you feeling? What was that like?
Oh, it was overwhelming, you know, to be like, I wasn't one of the casualties that had to pull out from serious injury.
Was it hard to finish the race?
It was, because it meant the end of some, like, you were sort of gunning to get there to go, like, I just want to finish this thing and give my knees and my ankles a break and my butt and have a shower. But you're like, this is, it's just such an extraordinary experience, you know. It means the end. All good things must come to an end. So I remember I was riding with two gentlemen whom I've never met prior to the race. Ben, a gentleman from the United Kingdom, and Will, an American. And we sat on top of this massive ridge amongst all the pine forest, this beautiful northern cool area. It could have been in Colorado, big eagle sort of circling over the top of us. And there's a little pile of rocks and a monument called an Ovu, which the Mongolians, you know, you can make little sort of gifts to the gods at these places. And we're sitting there smoking a cigarette, and we could see the flags at the finish line 5 to 6 kilometres away. And yeah, we sort of sat there for a while and just went, wow. This is it, gents. It's been an absolute pleasure riding with you. Sort of had a just laughing uncontrollably, going, oh, I remember that when we fell over in the river, or, oh, I hit that rabbit hole and I got javelin and head first in the ground. How did I not fracture one of my cervical vertebrae? I have no idea. And then kicked on, and we formed a cavalry charge towards the end, and some Mongolian herders sort of saw us and joined in, and we charged towards the finish line. And it was... yeah, it's almost anticlimactic. I remember dismounting off this horse and just sitting there in silence. Yeah, all three of us just like, oh my God, what do I process first? You know, the jubilation or the disappointment or the pain. Like, there was just so much going on.
So you spent the next few years in Central Asia, in places like Pakistan and Kazakhstan. What kind of work were you doing in that part of the world?
So I was really lucky to be involved in certain projects where Australian genetic material or livestock were going abroad. And the biggest thing was getting over there was to go like, okay, guys, you're in receipt of livestock, or you're going to breed them. Hey, you got to feed them, you got to water them. Let's do some vaccination protocols. So, yeah, it was really interesting being involved in building dairies from scratch, beef properties, finishing blocks. A lot of these postcodes and countries are subsistence farming, and, you know, it's not throwing shade at them, but just saying, hey mate, like, you've got to give animals water. It's a warm day. It's like, oh wow, I had no idea. So it was weirdly rewarding work to sort of go, I was working with, and these weren't just stockmen, other vets, just to go, okay, let's talk about immunology, let's talk about nutrition, let's talk about disease prevention. And yeah, that's what took me around the world on different projects.
So you were in Pakistan when you got the call to fly out to help out in Kazakhstan. What do you remember of that journey, getting out to Kazakhstan, this property in Kazakhstan?
We'd just finished talking to the Pakistanis about their dairy cows and gone and had a look at all these different farms and made a few suggestions here and there. I was in Lahore at the time, up in the north in the Punjab province, feeling quite ill. I'd had a bit of gastro, and I get this text message out of the blue going, hey, mate, we hear you're in Pakistan. Any chance you'd be able to go to Kazakhstan? And I replied promptly, said, yeah, I'm departing out of here in the next 12 hours, 24 hours. If you can get a flight to Almaty in Kazakhstan, I can go and have a look at your cattle. So, yeah, they wanted me there for about 10 days, 2 weeks, to go and have a look at some little Angus heifers that they were preparing for their first calving season ever.
So you went on the well-worn route from Lahore to Almaty.
I flew airlines I'd never heard before into airports I'd never heard before either, yep.
So you get into Kazakhstan. And what was the land like once you got out there?
Well, I landed, it was quite dark when I got into Almaty. So I'd gone from, you know, a quite, you know, clement temperature in Lahore to about 20 below in Almaty. It was proper winter at that time, and it was dark. So the gentleman met me at the airport in a big black SUV. Yeah, it looked very ex-KGB gangster. So, and we sped out through the night, and there's snow falling everywhere. And we get to this little farmhouse, and I rolled out a bit of a swag makeshift bed on the floor. So I didn't really know what the topography or the landscape looked like at all. And next morning I woke up and I sort of pulled the blinds, and there's this beautiful valley in front of us, full of snow. You know, could have been a ski slope out of Wyoming or Colorado. It was just absolutely amazing because we were right on the border with Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, and then where China meets both of those borders was sort of to the east. So it was a winter wonderland, and yeah, off to work we went.
Tell me about the workforce in Kazakhstan.
Had an interesting mix in Kazakhstan. So if we go back, obviously part of the Soviet Union, and there was a lot of Russians influence and placement of Russian citizens there. So yeah, we sort of had a half sort of Russian-backed workforce and a Russian identity workforce, and then local Kazakhs.
So you had like Orthodox Russians and Muslim Kazakhs, essentially.
100%, yeah. So we had different languages, different skin colours, different religions. Yeah, it was a lot of stuff to navigate.
I don't mean to bang on about the demon drink, but did that mean that you'd have some workers who'd be a bit keener on the drink than others?
Exactly, yeah. And I remember once we had some fencing to do, and I'd signed this gentleman out to go do some fencing with a quad bike and some pliers. It was probably 9 in the morning, 9:30, something like this. Anyway, I get a very angry phone call or text message via the very basic Wi-Fi that we had on the station from the boss. I didn't know he was driving out, but he'd been driving out in his big flash car and said, "Why the hell is one of my quad bikes on its roof? And the gentleman that's supposed to be in command of this, why is he sitting beside the road, you know, sinking bottles of vodka with his mate?" I was like, "Oh, I don't know what I can tell you. I only saw him an hour and a half ago, and it is still in the morning, and this guy is just blind drunk." So that was a big catalyst because obviously, you know, we had these two parcels of land, unsupervised, out driving, you know, no fences. I needed the guys to perform and be sober. So I started hiring more of the local Kazakhs. Number one, they're more literate with horse riding and living a bit rough and out bush. They loved it. You know, they were in their home environment. Number two, they were more likely to be Muslim, and that being the case, they're less likely to drink. So, yeah, I could send them out driving for weeks on end and know that there wouldn't be alcohol in the stock camp.
And their driving traditions that they have, how different were they compared to the ones you were familiar with in Australia, these Kazakh drovers?
Well, yeah, a lot of subsistence sort of farming there. So why did we go driving? Well, we had no fences and we had these big parcels of land up in the Alps at altitude. We're at about 300 metres above sea level. So we're sort of at the breaking point. Like, I used to get altitude sickness when we'd be drafting and vaccinating cattle, get really sunburned. I'd get headaches and sort of, yeah, feel quite ill. Yeah, I remember the boys, you know, saying like, "Oh, keep the mob together and push the cattle like this." They just weren't sort of, they'd sort of just let them go rogue and be like, "Oh, well, they'll all come together eventually." That was half the fun.
Don't they use eagles out there to help them drove, or falcons or something like that?
They do. So weirdly enough, between our farm and Almaty, there was a facility for eagle training. I remember driving into town to get some supplies and have a weekend off, and there's this van in front of us and all these fellas sitting in the back in the tray with all their eagles on their arms and a little hood. And I said to my trans, I was like, "Mate, what's going on here?" He's like, "Oh, sorry, didn't mean to, I forgot to tell you, that's just the eagle hunting facility and training school." I was like, "Excuse me, I probably would have liked to have known about this." So we did a handbrake turn and went in there to have a look around. And yeah, there's a lot of wolves in Kazakhstan, and the way that they protect their stock, you know, rather than just rifles, is, yeah, they ride around with an eagle on their arm and they deploy them to protect their cattle and sheep and goats from wolves taking them.
How do they do that? What, do the eagles attack the wolves?
Oh, it's pretty amazing stuff, to be fair. Yeah, the boys would literally be sitting there on their horse with their arm out and this little eagle on there, and they'd spot a wolf or you know, a predator incoming. They'd take the little hood off their eagle and it'd just go up into the air, flap its wings and get to a bit of altitude, like a drone, really. And then they just fold their wings in and dive down on them like a javelin. It's incredible to watch. And then they sort of, you know, get their talons into the back of these wolves and they can hit them with force and knock them over like the little foxes and stuff like this. And then they'll sort of, you know, if there's a couple of eagles, they'll they'll sort of go in a group formation and they sort of get on the ground and peck and dig their talons in, and they can you wouldn't think a bird of prey could inflict so much damage, but they'll either pin down the wolf or be able to inflict enough sort of encouragement to go, I think you should leave.
It's my God, what a spectacle that would be.
It was something else, yes.
Did you ever wonder whether that could be that kind of, well, we just don't have that tradition in Australia, but using eagles to keep wild dogs at bay? Is that a silly idea, or would that, did you ever think about that?
I don't think it's something that we can totally say no to. You know, we use llamas, Maremma dogs and alpacas and other things to guard our livestock in Queensland and Australia. So I think the eagle drovers per se, yeah, that was incredible to see. And definitely I was like, huh, there's a way to extend my horizons and think about something a lot differently. And it worked.
Indeed. And, you know, train the eagles to do it and then charge tickets to tourists to go and have a look at it.
Yes, exactly. Such a tourism
spectacular.
Such a spectacle. Yeah. And so regal, you know, to see this gentleman sitting there in sort of a hybrid of Western culture jeans and some sort of Kazakh tunics, just sitting upon his horse, totally relaxed, smoking a cigarette with an eagle just sitting on his gloved arm. It's pretty cool. It's pretty gangster. I'm not going to lie.
So those traditions that go back thousands of years are still being passed down to drovers?
To a certain extent, yeah, definitely. It was interesting comparing Mongolia and Kazakhstan. You know, I feel like Mongolia, you know, living in a yurt and the nomadic lifestyle and that kind of stuff after the, you know, the Soviet influence was really, really strong. Kazakhstan, I think, was still trying to, and this is just rhetorical in my experience, but yeah, they were still trying to work out what they were going to do. Like, you know, for example, when not long after I left, they started their constitution and talking in parliament in Kazakh rather than speaking in Russian. But the eagle hunting was definitely something that the Kazakhs were very proud of, and it was one of the traditions that had sort of shone through and was still getting used.
What was local law enforcement like in Kazakhstan, Campbell?
Non-existent. We had a beautiful, not far from my homestead, there was this beautiful lake, lagoon, a couple of decades ago, a small landslide, and it had plugged up this valley, and beautiful, beautiful. So there was a lot of people that used to go up there, tourists, you know, Kazakh tourists for a day out and a barbecue. And I remember, yeah, there was this hell of a vehicle that used to just rip up these just rough, bad dirt roads. And it was an old Russian-made larder. It was sort of, if you imagine a mandarin when you peeled it and someone's thrown it on the ground and it's had about, you know, a week or two to slightly decay, that's what the body looked like in texture and in colour. Well, apparently, and he was the local copper, I found out. The stockmen were wetting themselves laughing, going, oh, yeah, that's the police car there. So what he'd done is he'd rolled it, and, you know, I don't know whether they were adding more to this yarn or not, that, yeah, the copper had been a little bit under the influence and rolled it. So he tipped it back on his wheels and he cut the roof off. So I remember this sedan that had no roof, and you'd see about 12 people jammed into two bench seats in an off-colour Mandarin larder. And then he'd park it, and he had an Air Kazakhstan life raft from an airliner and some bungee cords to put over it to keep the rain out. And I was like, Air Kazakhstan, if you do a quick Wikipedia of that airline, it has been long extinct and had a very colourful history of interesting aviation procedures, yes. And somehow this guy had got one of the last remaining life rafts and used it as a makeshift roof.
That's where the safety equipment ended up.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So the plane crashes into the sea.
Yep.
You go for your life raft. Well, where is it? Well, it's on a police car.
Yeah, the copper stole it. Yeah. He's doing illegal charter drives out for tourists, yeah. So it was a law upon its own. You just had to read a room and try not to be, you know, oh, well, I'm the Australian expat and I know it. You're sort of like, oh, I'm going to read a room here and play the game, because if you heed people off, yeah, and they didn't like you, yeah, you're pretty vulnerable. So you just had to remember, I'm a guest here and I have to sort of, you just got to let it run its course and some of the local laws per se.
Those kind of stories are kind of like the stories I used to hear from my dad about what country life used to be like in Australia. We've been talking about the differences, but what about the affinities? Did you recognise some things in people living in outback, indeed outback Kazakhstan, as they would perhaps live in outback Australia?
100%. You know, like I remembered seeing those old, you know, Land Rovers and Land Cruisers have been dodgy together that would struggle to get a roadworthy certificate nowadays, totally being used in Kazakhstan or in Australia 30, 40 years ago. So I think I always enjoyed it. You know, they're sort of larrikin yarns and, like, they're still developing countries where they're just like, we don't care, you can do what you like. And I think I've always had an affinity, you know, with my father and my family and things that I remember when I was very, very young, very reminiscent of what it used to be.
So you came back to Australia, and just before COVID struck, you lost your dad in Queensland. What can you tell me about what happened there, Campbell?
Yeah, it was a weird day. It was the 9th of the 9th, 2019. Our family cattle property is on the Burdekin River, just outside of Charters Towers, and we have land on both sides. You've got to cross the river to get to one of the blocks of land. And my mother and father had saddled up to go and do some cattle work. 2019, if we recap, that was when that massive amounts of rainfall fell in Western Queensland and, you know, drowned thousands of head of cattle out at Cloncurry, Julia Creek. And obviously, so a lot of the rivers were running higher than normal, not bad, massive currents, not dirty, just silted and high water. So there's an area in the river that normally you'd walk across, you know, knee or hip deep in water, you know, with a couple of jerry cans of diesel on your shoulders to start a pump or put in a bulldozer. Anyway, my mother and father attempted to cross the river, and it was much deeper than normal. And the horse and my father got into trouble. The horse survived, but my father drowned, and it was a very sad day, very sudden experience to go through.
How about your mum? How was she going crossing that river?
Mum got into trouble, obviously I'm sort of just recounting from what my mother has told our family what happened that sad day. She was riding a horse behind him, and her horse sort of panicked as well. She fell in the water and was lucky enough to scramble onto some rocks and sort of get herself to safety. But unfortunately, the accident unfolded in front of her, and she sort of was the last one to see Dad alive as he came up for one of his last breaths and made eye contact with her. And she described his face as sort of going, well, I'm glad you're safe, and this is it for me. And he went down into the water. His cowboy hat floated on the river for a while, and then it sunk. It was almost sort of, you know, a cowboy Hollywood death. It was pretty traumatic for our family, especially my mother having to watch that. But thankfully, you know, I guess the weird silver lining of it was, well, Mum knew where he was. Queensland Police Service were absolutely fantastic to deal with during the whole ordeal. And it meant that because Mum knew where he was, we were able to retrieve his body. So, you know, that would have been a real heartbreaker to be at the homestead and a saddled horse just turns up at the homestead wet or dry and having no idea where he was. I would have liked to have said goodbye one more time, and you can't prepare for that. And that's something that haunts me a bit, just to have one more yarn with him and say goodbye, that gift that some people get when they know with chronic disease that it's coming. It was pretty quick. You know, we've got an old people's home in Charters Towers, and I've seen some great stockmen and some great people go in there and it, just watching them, you know, lie and slowly march to their death is, yeah, I think that would have been worse, and I wouldn't have liked seeing my father having to go through that.
Once your dad dies, I suppose, then you have to figure out who's going to run this, who's going to run the station, what's your mum's role is going to be, what's your role is going to be, what the brothers and sisters are going to do. It's a pretty busy time. Do you get time to grieve in that messy chaos afterwards?
In reflection, I don't think I did. Reflecting back to earlier in our conversation, you know, being the eldest son, maybe my siblings had say I'm out of line for saying it, but I definitely felt like I have to step up to the plate here and do my best to, you know, help everyone and keep everyone safe. There was a lot going on, you know. I guess a lot of families in agriculture, succession planning is a difficult narrative. And if we look at the statistics, you know, it's about 26% that go through favourable, you know, succession. So 3 out of 4 can end quite badly. You know, you're trying to grieve, you're trying to run a business, you're trying to run a cattle farm, you know, you're trying to be a son, a brother, a vet. It was a really difficult time, and I don't think I truly dealt for it for probably about 2 years. Yeah, it was really, really delayed. For me, reflecting on it, it was like, I'm just going to make sure everyone's okay first, and then I'll drop my guard and get a bit upset about this. So it's been a long, drawn-out, and it never stops. You know, I miss him every day. And you know, the best way that I've heard grief summarised is, you know, grief is love that doesn't want to quit. And, you know, the day I don't get sad is the day that I'm starting to forget, and I don't really want that to happen.
So not long after that, you moved into what is the next stage of the grieving process, which is to try and replicate the Mongol Derby in Patagonia, in South America.
Yeah, so we did the inaugural, the Gaucho Derby, a different model. You got a horse and a pack saddle, and on your pack saddle you'd have all your sleeping gear, survival gear and food, and sort of serpentipitously navigating, you know, alongside the Andes through some pretty rough country. So several months before Dad's accident, I'd been over there to do the recce, so the reconnaissance mission, go and map it out. That was spectacular to be with, you know, Argentine gauchos or cowboys camping out under the stars and no clients, no race to run, just to enjoy the moment and sort of see how challenging it was going to be. Dad had his accident, and yeah, a couple of months later, I found myself back in Argentina, and we were running the first race, and I was a mounted vet for that. So yeah, it was an interesting thing for the grief process, because I know, like, Dad had often, him and I had reflected on the Argentine cowboys and sort of, they call them estancias. Well, they're very, very similar to cattle stations in Queensland and Northern Territory. It's just they speak Spanish, and it's a little bit cooler in the winter. You know, it snows. And in the summer, it snows as well. So it's an amazing thing to sort of go and partake in and sort of reconnect with my international friends. You know, big support network for myself, the people that worked in Mongolia, and obviously were then working in Argentina at the time, sort of touch base. Returning to the horse and being, you know, out in the bush and riding around. I remember retracing my steps and explaining them to Dad, and then obviously doing them again and him not being with us anymore. It was an interesting and a really emotional time. Like, I remember a couple of times I'd see the big mountain there, Fitzroy, and I remember having photos of it and Dad being like, wow, that looks amazing, and explaining it to it, and then seeing it again and getting quite upset because, you know, I was like, oh, last time I looked at this, I was able to explain, and now he's gone. But that was an amazing experience, and it was really healing for me, and especially, you know, it was just before COVID, before, you know, there was sort of another jerk in the timeline of life, you know, a global pandemic.
So once it was up and running, did the inaugural Gaucho Derby go to plan, Campbell?
Sort of. So we all flew to South America and we heard about this disease called COVID, and it was bubbling away in China, and we're like, oh yeah, you know, whatever, it's just something, it'll be fine. I flew to Buenos Aires, and then I got on a plane down to El Calafate, and we went bush. We were cut off. We had sat phones for external comms, but, you know, there was no news headlines or radio or internet to sort of keep abreast of what was going on.
So you were right out of COVID world?
We had no idea.
That's kind of nice.
It was amazing, and it was surreal, you know, like, we had quite a nasty blizzard halfway through the race, and I remember trying to recover riders. I went up with some local Argentine gauchos, cowboys. You know, we rode up into the mountains into this really nasty, rough, wet, snowed-in country to sort of retrieve some riders that were in a bad way.
What state were they in when you got there?
Well, we couldn't get to all of them. Some of them we found and they were just pinned down, like everything was wet. Yeah, they were getting confused. The clouds had set in, so, you know, north, south, east, west, it was all just a overcast mess. You know, obviously they had GPSs and stuff, but the horses were trying to navigate through the bog, the snow. They were cold, they were wet, they were running out of food. It was in a nasty way. I remember I had a few pockets of satellite transmission to be able to get some coordinates on some riders near where we'd made a sort of retrieval base camp. And I walked on foot because I knew the horse wouldn't be able to get there. And I walked on foot and breaking through the wetness, and these girls huddled under a tarp. And I called out to them. I was like, oi, it's Cozzy. I'm here to, you know, we're here to take you down the mountain. And these two girls just came out and just bawled their eyes out. And I've never seen anyone so happy to see me before. They were just like, get us off this mountain. So we were able to get them out, but we had some really sick and compromised crew and riders on the other side of this big lake. We attempted to get across it, but we had like a 50-knot wind, and it was creating little like tornadoes, mini tornadoes, you know, a couple of feet high on the surface of the water. And I was like, we can't get, we're only about 5 kilometres from them, but if we cross this lake, we're going to get cold, we're already running low on supplies, we're going to get stuck and become a burden. So, but because the snowstorm had got more intense and the cloud cover, our satellite phones went off and our spot trackers, like, we were having really big problems getting comms. Anyway, I was able to limp a message out to go, we're going to retreat. we're done here. We're going to become a problem if we stay up here. You'll be rescuing the rescuers. So we retreated. Thankfully, I'd left my little GPS on and dropped a little trail because we got back to the forest and it was pitch black. We couldn't see any of the mountains, any of the moon, any sort of ways to navigate out because the tree canopy was just so thick. I couldn't even see my horse's head in front of my face. I could barely see it. I remember just following, you know, a little Hansel and Gretel trail of dots on this tiny little screen on a GPS about the size of a matchbox.
And you can't even see the horse you're riding on as you're doing that.
Like, I could barely see its head. I could barely see the ground in front of us. The one thing, the soil was sort of chalky, so the contrast between the leaf litter and the sort of cattle and livestock trail was about the only thing that I could barely make out. If I hadn't have put my GPS on going up, we would have had to camp out the night and I don't think it would have been very pleasant for us. So we were able to get back. We got back to base camp at about 10:30, 11 o'clock that night, just freezing. And we'd been ships in the night with the second rescue party. So they got up there, big mob of Argentinians and a couple of doctors, and they were able to get in there and sort of stabilise some people that were getting hypothermic. But yeah, we got back down and everyone was just like, we sort of rode into camp. Because we had spot trackers that had ping out, you know, our location, they couldn't see us because the cloud had got so thick. So we sort of arrived as a surprise and everyone was like, oh, mate, we thought we'd lost you. We thought there was big problems, you know, like it was quite an emotional sort of reunion. We'd started pinging our location a couple of kilometres out. So people sort of knew only last minute that we were there. And I remember just having a feed and standing near a fire and just being like, just shaking so cold.
Were you frostbitten?
I didn't get frostbite. I got a bit of frost nip. I remember losing sensation in the ends of my fingers for a couple of weeks. I had to keep taking my gloves off to be able to touch the screen of the GPS. So, you know, I was lucky I had some really good kit, but it had just, the conditions had gone so bad. Even the Argies were like, this is nasty. Lack of prep, not really, just really, really forced to the limits. So thankfully, had that blizzard lasted another 24 hours, I think we would have been in big problems, but we were spared. The weather broke. We woke up the next morning and just snow everywhere, beautiful snow-capped mountains all around us, and they got everyone out. They got everyone out, and the helicopter was able to get in and lift some people out that were in big problems and stabilise them in a hospital. It was absolutely fantastic.
And did you press on with the race afterwards?
We did. We restructured it. You know, obviously it was like, oh, God, we had to go and fetch all these people off the mountain. But, no, we cracked on, and there was able to have a finish and finish the rest of the race.
And what was the last obstacle of the race?
The last obstacle, so the soil there is quite loose. It's like a pot ash, little sort of shaley stones, so you can sink in and it's a bit, not slippery, but thankfully the horses over there, the Argentine Corriochos, or mixture in Spanish, are quite sure-footed and big horses. I'm a big fan of them. I love it. But yeah, just some really rough terrain that you've got to go pretty steady. You can't just gallop this. And the final river, so we came over this massive mountain pass, quite a very exposed ridge, and then down to a river. And we had to swim the river. And that was confronting for me because, you know, I'd only been 5-6 months and I didn't really think about it. And we're like, because you're like, yes, cool, we're going to finish this bloody race, get it over and done with. 6 months ago, my father was sort of attempting to cross a river on a horse. And I remember getting halfway through just going, oh, gosh, you know, like, I don't want this to go wrong. Yeah, it's pretty emotional sort of thing to go through. Just think that something so simple can just turn so badly. But, yeah, we finished. Thankfully, I got across the river safely and we got reunited with everyone and everyone's going, guys, what are you doing? You better get home. That's when we found out about COVID. That's where we found out that the world was ending.
So, again, these days you're in a plane as a vet servicing the top end.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think you do this thing for? What do you love about the life? Is it for the animals or for the adventure?
I think it's a mixture of both. You know, I don't really know what my destiny is on the cattle properties anymore is. So, in lieu of that, is being out in the bush is sort of, you know, it's a place, it's good for my head and my soul. So I think that's a pretty big driver to why I'm there. I get to supply skills and veterinary attention to animals and people and livestock that they just can't get. We've got sort of medical professionals permeating into those postcodes with the Royal Flying Doctor and federally funded, you know, medical drives. But the veterinary sector is really, I guess, sort of neglected. So, you know, unless you have a pilot's license or the ability to drive massive distances to get out there, these places miss out. I do enjoy the adventure, but I just enjoy, you know, I think of people like my family and my community where, you know, we're not in a metropolis, and just how much it means having a vet and how much of a difference you can make. I can make a lot more money, you know, working in the mines or you know, sitting behind a computer screen, but it's not rewarding work for me. You know, to be able to use my neurons and my brain is really important. But number two, I guess when you're a vet, you get to, it's life and death, and you get to hopefully make a difference, and that's really rewarding.
Campbell, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. I don't know if we've ever had anyone on this program who's got a life story just quite like yours. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.